Welcome to Circulation on the Run, your weekly podcast summary and backstage pass to the Journal and its editors. We're your co-hosts. I'm Dr. Carolyn Lam, associate editor from the National Heart Center and Duke National University of Singapore, here with my other co-host, a little bird that you can hear, I think, in the background, and then my real co-host, Greg.
Thanks so much, Carolyn. Yes, I'm Dr. Greg Hunley. I'm not the bird this week. Associate editor, director of the Pauli Heart Center in Richmond, Virginia. Carolyn, so this week, our feature discussion is really going to be on the importance of stable angina and what that means prognostically. But before we get to that, how about we grab a cup of coffee, talk to our other bird friends, and then we jump in and talk about the other papers in the issue. Would you like to go first?
Love it, Greg. Thank you so much. So, this first paper, very important question. We know that while the 99th percentile is the recommended diagnostic threshold for myocardial infarction, some guidelines also advocate the use of higher troponin thresholds to rule in myocardial infarction at presentation. It's still unclear whether the magnitude or change in troponin concentration can differentiate causes of myocardial injury and infarction in practice. And so today's paper is really important from Dr. Mills from the University Center for Cardiovascular Science, Royal Infirmary of Edinburgh in the University of Edinburgh and colleagues. So what they did was a secondary analysis of the high stakes trial of more than 46,000 consecutive patients with suspected acute coronary syndrome. They evaluated the performance of the 99th percentile rule-in threshold and thresholds of 64 nanograms per liter and 5 times the upper reference limit for the diagnosis of type 1 myocardial infarction. They found that troponin concentrations at presentation have a low positive predictive value for type 1 myocardial infarction, and a threshold of 50 times the upper reference limit is required to achieve a positive predictive value of more than 70%. A change in troponin on serial testing only marginally improved positive predictive value for type 1 myocardial infarction over the presenting troponin alone.
Interesting, Carolyn. Very important data. So what's our take-home message here?
Well, troponin concentrations at presentation are insufficient to distinguish type 1 myocardial infarction from other causes of myocardial injury or infarction and should not be used in isolation to guide management decisions in patients with suspected ACS. Consideration of other important clinical factors may be more helpful than any particular rule-in threshold to guide initial triage and management.
Wow, Carolyn. So really great new data and more data on the utility of these troponin concentrations. Well, my next paper comes from the world of preclinical science, and it's from Professor Vladimir Kalinichenko from Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. So Carolyn, as we know, pulmonary hypertension is a common complication in patients with alveolar capillary dysplasia with misalignment of pulmonary veins, a severe congenital disorder associated with mutations in the FOXF1 gene. Now, while the loss of alveolar microvasculature causes pulmonary hypertension in, and we're going to abbreviate this ACD-MPV patients, it is unknown whether increasing neonatal lung angiogenesis could prevent pulmonary hypertension and right ventricular hypertrophy in these subjects.
Wow. Okay, let's repeat that ACD-MPV stands for alveolar capillary dysplasia and misalignment of pulmonary veins. Really cool stuff. What did they find, Greg? I mean, this sounds like a first of its kind study.
Right, Carolyn, thanks. So the FOXF1 wild type, S52F mice, developed pulmonary hypertension and RV hypertrophy after birth. The severity of pulmonary hypertension in these mice directly correlated with mortality, low body weight, pulmonary artery muscularization, and increased collagen deposition in the lung tissue. Second, increased fibrotic remodeling was found in the human ACD-MPV lungs. Third, the mouse endothelial cells carrying the S52F FOX1 mutation were used to produce chimeras via blastocyst complementation and to demonstrate that the FOXF1 wild-type S52F endothelial cells have a propensity to differentiate into pulmonary myofibroblasts. And then finally, intravascular delivery of nanoparticles carrying STAT3 copy DNA protected the FOXF1 wild-type S52F mice from RV hypertrophy and pulmonary hypertension, improved their survival, and decreased that fibrotic lung remodeling. So, Carolyn, nanoparticle therapies increasing neonatal pulmonary angiogenesis may be considered to prevent pulmonary hypertension in alveolar capillary dysplasia with misalignment of pulmonary veins.
Wow. Thank you, Greg. Oh, such incredibly hopeful papers here. The next paper identified a key role of a particular amino acid in cardiac aging.
Ah, Carolyn. So you didn't ask me the quiz, but I guess it's implied here. Okay, I give up. Which amino acid is it?
Spot on, Greg. Well, the answer is phenylalanine. This is an essential amino acid whose levels are regulated by the tetrahydrobiopterin, or BH4-dependent, rate-limiting enzyme, phenylalanine hydroxylase, and whose expression is physiologically restricted to the liver and the kidney. Well, co-corresponding authors Dr. Zibik and Deremu from Paris, France, hypothesized that phenylalanine plays a causal role in promoting cardiac senescence and dysfunction based on prior evidence from human metabolomics that shed light on a link between amino acids, aging, and heart failure, as well as data showing that plasma levels of phenylalanine increase with age and inversely correlate with leukocyte telomere length. In addition, increased serum phenylalanine levels are associated with heart failure. So here, the authors tested their hypothesis in a series of elegant mouse experiments and showed for the first time that a decline in hepatic phenylalanine catabolism was a causal contributor to a rise in systemic levels, leading to cardiac ectopic phenylalanine hydroxylase activity and resultant cardiac aging. They demonstrated that phenylalanine administration induced a remarkable premature cardiac deterioration in young mice, closely mimicking that of aged mice and leading to cellular senescence in vitro. They identified hepatic phenylalanine catabolism to decline with age in a P21-dependent manner, while demonstrating that P21 deficiency prevented age-related cardiac dysfunction. Administration of phenylalanine hydroxylase cofactor BH4 or dietary phenylalanine restriction both abrogated the age-related rise in the plasma levels and reversed age-associated cardiac alterations. So this study really identifies phenylalanine and its hydroxylase modulation as a potential therapeutic strategy to promote cardiac health and prevent age-related cardiac impairment. Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, Carolyn, really interesting about phenylalanine and while it may impact cardiovascular health and the aging process. Well, I know we've got some other articles in this issue, so how about I'll go and dip into the mailbag first. So the first is from Professors Wong and Finn, and they're exchanging letters regarding the prior publication entitled Microthrombi as a Major Cause of Cardiac Injury in COVID-19, and it's a pathologic study. There's a nice research letter from Dr. Arias entitled Catheter-Based Adrenal Ablation Remits Primary Aldosteronism, a Randomized Medication-Controlled Trial. There's a perspective piece from Dr. Stelic entitled The Long and Winding Road to an Effective Left Ventricular Assist Device, The Demise of Medtronic's HVAD. And then finally, a report from Dr. Mehta and colleagues. Really, Carolyn, thinking about clinicians' well-being and addressing global needs for improvements in the healthcare field. And it's a joint opinion representing the American College of Cardiology, the American Heart Association, the European Society of Cardiology, and the World Heart Federation. So really a nice report on really addressing physician stress in the workplace.
Nice. Well, there's also an ECG challenge by Dr. Shi entitled An Acutely Breathless Patient with Inferior ST Segment Elevation, a Diagnostic Trap. In cardiology news, Bridget Kuhn describes studies detailing heart risks for firefighters. Wow, what an interesting issue. But let's go on now to the featured discussion, shall we, Greg?
You bet. Welcome, listeners, to our feature discussion. And today we have with us Dr. Gabriel Steig from Paris, France, Université de Paris, and also Dr. Greg Stone, an editorialist from Mount Sinai in New York. Welcome, gentlemen. And Gabriel, we'll start with you first. Could you describe for us some of the background related to your study, and what was the hypothesis that you wanted to test?
Well, thank you, Greg. As you know, there have been tremendous changes in cardiology over the past 25 years with the advent of effective anti-angiogenic therapy, with the advent of myocardial revascularization and the dramatic changes produced by widespread availability of percutaneous coronary intervention, and finally, the availability of evidence-based secondary prevention therapies. And there's been really a sea change in the presentation and treatment, management, and outcomes of patients with coronary artery disease. And when we started off, we asked ourselves, is angina pectoris really prognostic in patients with stable coronary artery disease? Is the symptom of angina really prognostic? So that was the question we tried to address.
And Gabriel, what was your study population and your study design?
So it was a very simple descriptive design. We used a large international registry of patients with stable coronary artery disease called the CLARIFY registry, which enrolled almost 35,000 patients with stable coronary artery disease and followed them up for 5 years. Now, how was stable coronary artery disease defined? It was defined as any of the following conditions: a prior MI more than 3 months before enrollment, a prior PCI or a CABG, angina pectoris with a demonstration of myocardial ischemia on non-invasive stress testing, or finally, the presence of a fixed stenosis of the coronary arteries on an angiogram. And you could get any of these criteria. Of course, you could have more than one at the same time. Yeah, and the design was to describe the anginal status at baseline and every year based on investigator reports, not a formal angina questionnaire, as there are several, including the CEDAL angina questionnaire. We had a very simple assessment of angina and angina severity based on presence or absence, and then Canadian class of angina.
And did you follow these individuals did they experience specific events?
Yes. So we collected all the cardiovascular hospitalizations, events, revascularizations. We followed the medications, and we collected the biological results of although there was no core lab, but we collected the results of the tests that were done. So we essentially aimed with that registry to describe the population, their management, and their outcomes over 5 years. And this is over 40 plus countries. Unfortunately, it does not include any patient from the United States, but has a substantial contribution from Canada and Mexico.
Very nice. And so what did you find, Gabriel?
Well, the first observation is the prevalence of angina at baseline, and it's 22%. So we found that in a patient population selected for having stable coronary artery disease, approximately a fifth to a quarter will have anginal symptoms. I don't think that's a major surprise, but what was a big surprise to us is that angina resolved very, very substantially. 40% of the patients who had angina at baseline had no longer angina by 1 year. And what was even more surprising is what caused the resolution of angina. And it was rarely changes in anti-anginal medications, rarely revascularization. It was largely spontaneous. Almost 80% of the patients had spontaneous resolution of angina. And so, yes, this is it's been known that angina can regress, but we did not expect that it would regress that often and that much spontaneously without intervention or need for increasing medications. And the other aspect is then we looked at what happened for those patients who had angina resolution at 1 year, and what were the subsequent outcomes? And we found they were indistinguishable from those who had no angina at baseline. And then we looked at those patients who had persistent angina at 1 year or occurrence of angina at 1 year despite not having angina at baseline. And again, we found that having angina at 1 year was detrimental to long-term prognosis. So it's really good that you either not have angina or that your angina resolved. That's really important.
Did you find any differences, Gabriel, between men and women?
No. We looked at a variety of subgroups. We looked by criteria for enrollment. We looked across geographic locales. We looked according to the presence or absence of diabetes and sex and other variables. And there were really no major differences. The results were remarkably consistent.
Very nice. Well, listeners, one of the advantages of some of the publications that we pursue at Circulation is the ability to bring in an editorialist. And with us today, we have Dr. Greg Stone from Mount Sinai in New York. And Greg, I want to turn to you. How do we put the results of this study in perspective with other studies that have been involved in this sphere of research?
Well, thank you, Greg. First off, I'd like to congratulate Gabriel and his colleagues for a tremendous study, and thank you and Circulation for offering David Waters and I the chance to provide our perspectives. I think this study raises a lot of important issues. Angina is kind of like the common cold to cardiologists. We're always dealing with it, but it can be very difficult to diagnose. There's typical angina, atypical angina, anginal equivalent disease, non-anginal chest pain, et cetera. And we've learned in the last several years or decade that the etiology of angina can be very complex. It's not just epicardial coronary disease. There can be microvascular disease, macro or microvascular spasm, and other causes. So I think that we have to, when we're thinking of angina, we have to try to understand the mechanism and know whether or not it's really due to at least epicardial coronary artery disease, which is the type of disease that may respond to revascularization. In this regard, both David and I were struck with the fact that the CLARIFY, even though a very large population, is a very mature population of patients with coronary disease, who I believe were diagnosed at least approximately 7 years ago. Most had undergone a prior revascularization therapy, about 50% had had a myocardial infarct. And the minority, interestingly, had inducible ischemia. You know, we wondered, is this real angina? Is this true angina that these patients are having because they've been effectively revascularized? In contrast, I was one of the co-principal investigators of the ischemia trial, which was a very different population because we took patients only with exercise-induced moderate or severe ischemia. And while we excluded most patients with class 3 or 4 angina, because we know those patients basically don't tolerate medical therapy without frequent crossovers, we found that in our trial, angina was more persistent and was substantially reduced by revascularization, by an interventional approach, much more so than in the medical therapy arm. So I think that it really does depend on the patient population and the likelihood of which the angina is due to true inducible ischemia that may respond to a revascularization approach.
Very nice. And so, Gabriel, I want to turn back to you. What do you think is the next study that really needs to be performed in this space?
Well, I think it's really in line with Dr. Stone's comments. I think that what we need to do is to have a much more formal prospective assessment of a broader population of patients with angina using formalized questionnaires, such as the CEDAL angina questionnaire, which allow a much better and thorough characterization of the presence, type, and severity of symptoms, and to look across the whole spectrum of patients with and without myocardial ischemia and look at the prognostic importance of these symptoms. I think that teasing out the relationship between the anginal symptoms, their severity, myocardial ischemia, and outcomes is really critical to our interpretation of the series of recent trials, the last of which being ischemia, which have revolutionized our thinking regarding management of coronary artery disease. And we're still somewhat in the dark as to how to incorporate that information relative to the symptoms and outcomes of our patients. And I think we still have a lot of work to do in that respect.
Very good. And Greg, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly echo Gabriel's comments. In addition, I think we have to think of angina as a collection of different diseases. And we have to do a better job at trying to understand the mechanisms underlying angina. First, we have to be able to determine whether it's really cardiac in origin versus non-cardiac. And then second, we have to understand, again, whether it's coming from epicardial coronary disease, microvascular disease, or other mechanisms. We've just been struck in even many of our simple stent studies how often patients redevelop angina after treatment with no restenosis whatsoever, suggesting that many of them may have other etiologies of angina. So I think these studies to me are very important because they really highlight, yes, how much we've learned, but how much more work there still is to do for us to be able to effectively diagnose and treat these patients.
Well, listeners, we want to thank both Dr. Gabriel Stagg, the author of this paper, and also Dr. Greg Stone, who provided his editorial expertise and bringing to us information from these 32,000 plus individuals from the CLARIFY registry of patients with stable coronary artery disease and helping us answer really two questions regarding the presence of angina. One, both that angina may resolve spontaneously, and then second, persistent angina is associated with future cardiovascular events. Well, on behalf of Carolyn and myself, I want to thank our speakers and then also wish everyone a great week, and we will catch you next week on The Run. This program is copyright of the American Heart Association 2021. The opinions expressed by speakers in this podcast are their own and not necessarily those of the editors or of the American Heart Association. For more, visit ahajournals.org.